is February 14th, and this is Rabbi Adler Shiur.
Bokatov, as we get closer to the season of the Chagim, Purim and Pesach, and we naturally gravitate to subject matter that pertains to the Chagim, but we have an off week this week. This coming Shabbat is between Parshat Shkalim and Parshat Zachol, so while the supermarkets are already selling Hamantashen, but they've been doing that already for a month and a half. After the last Sufganiyah goes after Hanukkah, the next thing you see on the shelves, so the Hamantashen. But nevertheless, an opportunity yet to touch on another subject of our overall topic for the year, the rendezvous of science and the Torah. And one of the burning issues on a very, very practical level that has hit the desks of great Gedolei Yisrael in terms of rendering halachic decisions takes us back to 1968. It's not a long time ago. And that's the issue of organ transplants. I say 1968 because in South Africa there was Christian Barnard was a surgeon, and he was a pioneer in the heart transplant department. Later on, went to the United States, a doctor by the name of DeBakey in Texas, and there was Dr. Kantrowitz at the Maimonides Hospital in Borough Park, and then others, and it became a procedure for people who had irreversible heart damage. There was some exploration with mechanical hearts, but they just never made it, But the idea of human transplant of a heart could work. Lung transplants, as we know, they do. Kidney transplants, they do. But there, the issues are much less because we receive kidney donations from, most often, it comes from live people, people who donate one of the two kidneys. And apparently, a Kadosh Baruch Hu created two so that one can be offered to help somebody else. And the reason I say that is obviously Kadosh Baruch Hu created two because we need two, except that a person can get along with one. And there are organizations, both here in Eretz Israel and Chutz Laaretz, that promote kidney donations and to be available to donate. And that's a process in itself. But the real issue, the reason why even on kidney donation there was a need for some type of a halachic green light is because every time you subject yourself to surgery, whether it's minor surgery or major surgery, that's under full anesthesia, you actually are subjecting yourself to a risk. There is a small amount of people, very small, but nevertheless it's there, who never wake up from the anesthesia. And this has happened even on the dentist chair in Yerushalayim. I don't want to go back to some tragic cases. But these things can happen. Now, I'm not here to tell you not to have Novocaine when you go for the dentist. But the fact is that anesthesia itself is potentially hazardous and should only be used when there's a need. For example, Rav Moshe Feinstein Zatzal, when talking about cosmetic surgery, there would also be a need for anesthesia. Rav Moshe allowed it for women to go through cosmetic surgery as an easier psak than for men, because he said that for some women it's pikuach nefesh. Now he didn't say it facetiously. He said that it really meant something more. It meant more to a woman to have a nose corrected or something of this nature that give her a better appearance. And with a man, Rav Moshe thought it was less pertinent, less burning. Here in Eretz Israel, we have most probably the best department for cosmetic surgery. It's up in Rambam Hospital in Haifa. And it developed well because of unfortunate circumstances, the wars, and fellows who were burnt in tanks, warfare, and so on, and they had to have their faces redone. And you have today surgeons who are really experts in putting together what people should look like after major injuries. So on that score, Rav Moshe Feinstein never would have said, you know, you can't do cosmetic surgery. He was talking about normal cosmetic surgery in the Western world for appearance purposes. But the reason why he had this hedging and hawing against men doing cosmetic surgery, because he felt that the risk outweighed the benefit, and the risk was always going under the knife. And that he felt, you know, had to be measured. And certainly with regard to kidneys, so here, it's a life-saving procedure. So obviously the donor, who is going to be operated as well, and with all risks intended, and you hope that the donor was fundamentally healthy and recovers from the operation without any long-range problems, and usually that's the case. So the gains, the benefits, outweigh the risks, you know, exponentially. So therefore, it's certainly okay. But the problem with the organ transplants that we talk about today is after a person is fundamentally dead and he's donating organs to save somebody else's life. So what should be the problem? Saving a life is obviously one of the highest values of Judaism. The basic core issue is that when the doctors remove the vital organ, it is very possible that the person is not yet halachically dead. And hence, by removing that vital organ, the doctor is actually killing the person. Even the person will be dead within an hour or 2 hours or 3 hours. I mean, there's no question the person has a halakha of a goses. Goses means 1 foot out. But you're not allowed to hasten the death of a person even by one split second. So the question is, would you be allowed to violate on some level a isur, the prohibition of lo tirtzach, in order to save somebody else? This is a very, very, very delicate issue, because there is a difference of opinion amongst the great halachas of the late 20th century, what constitutes the moment of death, the critical moment. And according to one opinion, it's enough time to save the vital organ, and according to another opinion, it's too late to save the vital organ. So if you take the stricter opinion, as they say, you're machmer, what you're really doing is shutting the door to many, many potential donors. And that's something that, you know, you have to assume responsibility for. The card, I happen to hold two different cards. One is the HOD from the United States, and one is the ADI from here, from Israel, that you get anytime you renew your license. So on the HOD, there's an option. You have to fill out a form, and it's so checked on the card itself. So the first one is, it says, irreversible cessation of autonomous breathing, which is confirmed by brainstem death. I understand this option allows full recovery of all organs. Parenthesis, this is the position of the chief rabbinate of Israel. This was printed in America. The main posek who's behind what I just read now was Rav Moshe Feinstein, that's all. And then there's the second possibility that a person can check. Irreversible cessation of heartbeat, not respiration. I understand this option significantly limits the possibility of donation and significantly limits the number of organs that may be recovered. So this was the opinion of Rav Bleich, David Bleich, in America, who challenged Rabbi Tendler, who was Rav Moshe Feinstein's son-in-law. And here in Eretz Yisrael, Rav Yoshev was the big proponent of that second opinion. But nevertheless, on this very podium several months ago, I heard most probably the greatest expert to talk on this subject, a tremendous Talmud Chacham and a wonderful, wonderful neurosurgeon, physician, Rav Avram Steinberg, or Dr. Avram Steinberg. In his spare time, he's the editor of the Encyclopedia Talmudit. In his spare time, I mean, that's a full-time endeavor. You have to be a tremendous, tremendous Talmud Chacham to do that alone, and yet that's what he does on his spare time. The editor, the general editor of the Encyclopedia Talmudit. But he's a Charit Tzedek and lectures worldwide. He's a wonderful, wonderful person. And there was an occasion here on this podium where he addressed the subject. I heard him at rabbis' conferences several times over. And he's really the person to talk about the history of the organ transplants and where the halacha stands exactly. He was in on the discussions with Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach and with Rav Yoshev, and he knew Rav Moshe Feinstein's view very, very well, and so on. and was part of the Knesset discussions of how to legalize this back in 2009 by a Chaver Knesset, Otniel Schneller, who tried really to put some, you know, finality to how we deal with things here in Israel. And that's really the law in the last 9 years. And just the past Shabbat, I have a gentleman in shul. His name is Dr. Kobi Shapiro, a very fine gentleman, Ben Torah, and a jurist, a legal expert. And he also represents the case various times in the Knesset committees. Told me that there's something cooking in the Knesset to even refine it even further. He promised me that he would send me over the email before after Shabbat, which I didn't get yet, what's the latest out of the shizzle in this area, but it makes no difference for this discussion. So I'm not here to compete with the greats like Professor Steinberg and others who can give you the full view of everything that's happened and where we stand today and so on. I'd like to deal with a more halachically and spiritually oriented discussion about the subject, knowing that indeed the Adi card, which is done here in Israel, allows for, when you fill out an application, to check, number one, if a person is interested, if God forbid something catastrophic happens, and the person is killed. Usually it's in some type of an accident. The best donors are those 20-year-olds who are killed in motorcycle accidents because they die from head concussions, whereas their 20-year-old bodies are nice and healthy. Their lungs, their hearts, their kidneys, their corneas perhaps are still okay. Whatever it is, they're still in good shape for purposes of transplant. There is a list, and one can say whatever any other person needs. And the other list, the other is a detailed list where you check off, you know, you prepare to give this or that, and they would honor it. That's one listing. And the other is that on the condition that a religious person, according to the choice of the family, will approve this kind of a donation. And the donation will not be used for research, but for transplant purposes only. So this is available. When this Adi organization started, it was not available. You just had to sign on the dotted line that you're prepared to donate an organ. But this has been challenged and it's been changed to allow for more and more people to become signers and become available. Both from Professor Steinberg and from Rav Tendler, I heard it's embarrassing statistics, and sometimes embarrassing things have to be said in order to try to promote a change, and that is that the Jews are very much on the higher end of the spectrum when it comes to the receiving end of donated organs, and pretty much on the lowest of the totem pole when it comes to donating. Yeah, Rivka, did I say something wrong?
Yes, no.
Oh, okay.
No, I thought that Jay's grandson-in-law donated a kidney, and they had just 2 weeks ago. A weekend, they took these people away he said most of the people there were Haredi.
So right. There is an organization here, Matnat Chayim, that's a Haredi organization to promote kidney transplants. And kidney transplants is probably the easiest thing to deal with because we're not talking about an autopsy. We're talking about an operation of the donor. And obviously that allows for a better chance to get cooperation from people. One of the issues we have in Israel is that the donor, it has to be altruistic in terms of you're going to give it to anybody who needs it, unless there's a specific donor, a recipient, potential recipient waiting, where it's in the best interest of the recipient to receive, let's say, from an immediate member of the family. Like, you know, many of you know that my older brother, Rabbi Yosef Adler, had 2 years ago a kidney transplant, and his son was the donor. And Baruch Hashem, it's held and continued to hold. And both are doing great. So that's for sure. That's for sure. But I'm talking about heart transplants and lung transplants and so on, where clearly in the general religious world, specifically in the Haredi world, it's very, very low. And it's low because of the halachic opposition to some of the poskim, which made it for some people even impossible. But let me just tackle some of the lesser halakhic issues, and then we'll see that we can put those aside and deal with the more pertinent. You look at the source page. So number one, you have the basic famous Gemara in Maseret Baba Kama that allows that shows that Judaism is not Christian Science. We do not believe that if God made you sick, then that's the way it's to be, and if you end up succumbing to the illness, that's God's will, and just do not intervene. That's not our religion. The Braita says, the Tanya, the Bei Rabbi Yishmael, in the school of Rabbi Yishmael, Verapo Yirape, we just read the Pasuk Le Shabbat in Mishpatim, Mikan Shenitan Rishut L'Rofei L'Rapo. From here you see that the permission was granted to the physician to heal. Which means there was a need for the Torah to state it. There was a need. The Rambam, as you know, was a physician. Ramban was also a physician. But the Rambam was a practicing physician in the house of the Sultan. And then he also ran a clinic in Fostat, Old Cairo. The Rambam receives a letter from a correspondence student who lived in Aleppo. Aleppo's in Syria. It's what we call Halab. We hear all about it in the news in the last few years, in the war, the civil war there. Aleppo was a thriving Jewish community in the Middle Ages. And the Rambam had a student. His name was Rabbi Yosef ben Yehuda ibn Enkin, who was really the reason for the book of the Guide to the Perplexed. He wrote a series of correspondence letters to the Rambam. You know, in those days, it took almost as long for a letter from Chalab to get to Cairo as a mail from Tel Aviv to Yerushalayim. Almost as long. Right. So you can imagine the slow process of the correspondence, but nevertheless, what ultimately came out of this was a book called Moreh Nevuchim. And so this Rabbi Yosef ben Yehuda ben Enkin is dying to meet the Rambam and is willing to make a trip. I mean, you have to go to a port city in Lebanon, which was Syria then, and take a trip to Alexandria and make it down to Cairo on a donkey. It's doable. It's a long trip. And the Rambam writes to him, I really love to have visits, I'd love to meet you and so on, but here's my daily schedule, and I'm sorry, I don't have a moment for you. And it turns out that from the 24 hours of a day, 20 hours are effective hours. They're used in terms of, he slept 4 hours, basically. And he starts up in the morning by making this long journey to the palace of the Sultan, and then he has to be there all day, and that's when everybody's healthy, and if people are sick, it's even longer. And then he gets back, it's the mid-afternoon. He said he hasn't eaten breakfast yet at 3 in the afternoon. He hasn't touched the, and his clinic is packed with patients, and he begs them a moment so he can just, you know, chop a bite, as we say, just eat something. And then he treats these people until the nighttime hours. And then he starts learning. Then he starts writing. You know, the Rambam, as we know, you know, he had time to write at this after an exhausting day. You know, completely exhausted. The man was superhuman, no question. So the Rambam was indeed a physician, and apparently to him, the word reshut, permission granted for a rofe to heal, was not good enough. Because the word reshut in the halakhic language means optional. There's that we use it in that context. We use chayav, obligatory, and reshut, optional. So of course in the context here, it doesn't mean it's optional. It means permission. Permission is granted for the rofe. Don't think that, as the Pasuk says in Bishalach, Ki ani Hashem rofecha, I am God your physician. That means you don't need a doctor. No. Rapo yirape. Human intervention, human hishtadlut, human involvement is critical, and you should go for it. As the Rambam wrote in his tefillah for the rofe, that he's a shaliach, he's a go-between between the Kadosh Baruch Hu and the patient to get the job done. And we all hope that the doctors are shlichim ne'emanim, are faithful shlichim to our Kadosh Baruch Hu. But the Rambam in source number two, of all places, it's the Masechet Nedarim in his Mishnah commentary. He teaches us something interesting. If a person has a broges with a neighbor, now I know you don't know what I'm talking about because we all live in peace and tranquility and harmony with all our neighbors. But once upon a time, there was a thing called a broges, that the one neighbor had it out with the other, to the extent that one neighbor puts the other one in nidui. Nidui is like excommunication of sorts. It makes a neder. I don't have anything to do with him. It makes such a promise, a neder. I don't have anything to do with him. So let's assume the guy happens to be a plumber, the next door neighbor, and all of a sudden, you know, you got to spring a leak in a pipe. You can't use him because you don't want to have anything to do with him. Fine, okay. But what if that person gets sick, that neighbor gets sick, and you happen to be a doctor? So the Mishnah says you are allowed to heal him. And that's called Refuat Nefesh. If you look at source number 2, Hu Shiyarape Oto, that's when you're healing the person. But the Mishnah also talks about Refuat Mamon, his property, which in this case it means his animal. Let's say you're a veterinarian and his animal's sick. So would you be able to assist the animal even though you put him out of the pail, made a nether not to have anything to do with him? Rambam simply defines the terms Refuat Nefashot, Shiyarape Oto, you're healing him. Rufuat Mamon, you're curing his property. Hu Shiyarape Behemto, you're going to cure his animal. Umutar lo lomar lo ma yo'il levemto, velo nesar alav ele rapota biado. Which means, even if you're a vet, you're not allowed to cure the animal, but you can give him an eitzah, you can give him an advice, what to do. You know what? Call that other guy, he'll be able to save your animal. You can't do it. But in terms of the chole atzmo, if the neighbor himself is sick, velo nesar ze lechole atzmo. No, you never would say that the neighbor who threw the other one in cherem or nidui, you can't save him, you can't help him. But they shehi mitzvah. It's a commandment. It's a fulfillment of a mitzvah to save him. Klomar, that is to say, shechayav harofei min hadin lerapot cholei Yisrael. It is obligatory for a rofe to save the sick. What's his source? His source is not verapo yirapei. His source is restoring lost objects, hashavat aveda. When a person is sick, he's lost his health. So when you restore the person's health, you are in fulfillment of hashavat aveda. And it's interesting, that's why the Rambam says, lirapot cholei Yisrael. What about to cure the sick of the non-Jew? So the reason why the Rambam says cholei Yisrael, he doesn't say it's an aveira to cure or help cure the non-Jewish sick. He says the mitzvah of Hashavat Aveda as a mitzvah of Hashevotolo is limited to Am Yisrael, as the Torah says, L'chol Avedat Achicha, your brethren. Which means that technically in the context of Hashavat Aveda, restoring lost articles, under that category, it's between Jew and Jew. But then Chachamim came along and reminded us that there's a super category in Torah, and that's called Darkei Shalom. Darkei Shalom means to promote harmony amongst human beings. Human beings. Darkei Shalom is not Jewish, it's above the world. It's called Meta Halacha. And our great Rebbe Rabbi Lichtenstein, Zichron Lebracha, wrote a whole article about this many, many years ago before I even knew of Rabbi Lichtenstein. The article is called, Is there ethics beyond Halacha? And he talks about Lefnim Mishurat Adin, he talks about Darkei Shalom, all kinds of categories that the Halacha knows, is acquainted with, but it's way beyond the detailed Halacha. And he explained that many people see things in Chazal that we do this because of Darkei Shalom. It's like apologetics, it's pasnish, it doesn't look good if we don't do that. So we give tzedakah also to the poverty stricken of the Gentile world, because it's pasnish, nobody, you're not going to give them, and so on. How can you do that? Rabbi Aaron said this has nothing to do with this pasnish. He says it has to do with the fact that in order for a social mitzvah to be in force, and those are the mitzvot ben adam l'chaviro, both parties have to have standing at Har Sinai to receive the mitzvah, both the giver and the receiver. But if one party wasn't there at Har Sinai because the person happens to be a goy, then that mitzvah is not binding on the first person either. So there had to be some type of outside the framework of Har Sinai category that will allow to govern proper relationships between Jews and non-Jews as human beings. And Rav Aaron said that's called Darkei Shalom. So I remember we lived in Be'er Sheva. So I used to get tons of mishloch manot from people in my congregants. I was rabbi in Young Israel there. They brought over, this is the last thing you need a month before Pesach, all this chazarai and all the vaflim and the bagelach and the don't ask what. And you don't know what to do with it, right? How much can you eat already? And most of it is packaged stuff anyway, right? So I would send my kids to 2 blocks away to the Soroka Hospital, to the children's ward. Give it out. That's all. Give it out. That's all. In one swipe, I got rid of all the mishloach manot. Fine. So I remember one of my kids said, in Soroka, half the kids there are Bedouin kids. I said, you give them also. Because mechalkin ma'ot matanot avyonim, L'aniyei akum ipnei darkei shalom. That's what they did. Yeah, Baksha.
As a nurse in Shari's headache, I took care of lots of patient children, handcuffed children.
Right. Right. Handcuffed children. Right. 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 Yeah, I have no choice. No, that I have stories also from the wars with one of my own kids. I'm saying that darkei shalom is very, very important. And therefore, shall a doctor go out of his way to heal the sick of the non-Jewish world? The answer is categorically yes, because of darkei shalom. So the reason why the Rambam says in this source, Shechayav Arofei Min Adin Lerabot Chulei Yisrael, because he's using Hashavat Aveda as his proof text, and that's limited to Am Yisrael. But then, carried a step further, in Hashavat Aveda, the Rambam says that there's a possibility of Kiddush Hashem by returning the stolen article to the non-Jew, because of Darkei Shalom. So he says, so basically that's his point with regard to medical as well. Now, we know that saving a life does away with Shabbat, which means Shabbat does not stand in the way. In source number 3, the famous halacha from the Rambam Luchot Shabbat, "Dechuya hi Shabbat etzel sakanat nefashot kisha'ar kol ha-mitzvot," just like any other mitzvah does not stand in the way of pikuach nefesh. We know that only on 3 principal avirot is a person supposed to surrender his or her life. Of avodah zarah, gilui arayot, shvichut damim, on idolatry, on murder, on adultery, on those 3 averot, it's yeharei va'al yavor. But everything else, saving of life precedes. It deflects any other obligation, and we know this. And the Rambam goes on to say at the end of that paragraph, shesafek nefashot doche et haShabbat. The Rambam says, number one. Let's read this whole halakha because it's very, very important. Dechuya hi Shabbat etzel sakanat nefashot kishar kol ha-mitzvot. Shabbat is pushed aside in face of mortal danger, like any other mitzvah. Lefikach, therefore, cholesh yesh bo sakana, a person who is in mortal danger, osim lo kol tzrachav b'Shabbat, you do everything that the person needs, al pi rofei uman, by a professional. An expert. The Rambam does not consider it important at all that you look for a Jewish doctor. He thinks you need the biggest expert. That's the person you need, the expert. Shel oto makom, of that area. You look for the best doctor in the field, as we say. Safek shehu satzrit v'chalel Shabbat, or safek sheno tzrit. Let's assume it's a borderline case. You're not sure, maybe you can get away with not doing Shabbat. Does he need the ambulance? Does he not need the ambulance? You know, it's 3 hours before Havdalah. Maybe we can wait it out. You know, you start thinking. Or, the Rambam says, V'chein im omar rofe l'chalel alav Shabbat. Rofe acher, omer eino tzarib. 2 doctors are on the case. And one says, you know, I think we should bring him to the hospital. And the other one says, no, I think we can deal with it here. L'chalel alav Shabbat. Don't think twice. Why? Safek nefashot, doche et Shabbat. A doubt of maybe it's a mortal, situation, danger. So you surrender Shabbat because of it. You don't take chances. Pashut, no. We're not going to fool around here. With you want it on your shoulders and your responsibility because you're a tzaddik. And then the Rambam goes on in the third halacha, the third paragraph. Kishosim dvarim ha'elu, ein osim oto lo ayde goyim v'lo ayde ketanim v'lo ayde avadim v'lo ayde nashim. You do it. You're the God Lador. You pick up the phone and call. Don't start delegating this to people who you think might be spiritually inferior to you. No, you do it. Dolei Yisrael b'chachamehem. You have to show the example that this is something that you have to do. Now, the only question is, I don't want to digress too much from this discussion, but I'll just say it in a word. The question is, when we do something on Shabbat, which would be ordinarily an act of Chilul Shabbos, desecration of Shabbat, because of Pikuach Nefesh, because we have a serious crisis at hand, does that mean that for all intents and purposes, it's Tuesday or it's Wednesday? I mean, forget about Shabbat, just do what you have to do and Shalom Yisrael. Or, I still have to remember that it's Shabbat, and I have to consider how I'm going to do what I'm doing so that won't, put the person at risk. It won't be time consuming. I can do 2 different things. One is a biblical violation, one is a rabbinic violation. Do I have to think about it as I'm going to assist that individual? Or just forget about it. Just do what you have to do like it's Tuesday. Don't even give it a moment's thought. That's a dispute. That's a machloket. Whether this is called dechuya or it's called hutra. Dechuya means that the Shabbos violation is put on the side, except that the Shabbos violation is still there. Except that you're allowed to do it. You're allowed to violate the Shabbat because of pikuach nefesh. But the violation is still there, staring at you in the face. Hutra means it's non-existent. It's been permitted. It is no longer considered a desecration of Shabbat. Not only is it a desecration of Shabbat that's permissible, but it's an act that's not even a desecration of Shabbat. And this is not semantics. There are many, many different applications and ramifications to this. It's interesting that the Rambam in source number 3 at the beginning uses the word Dechuya hi Shabbat etzel sakanat nefashot, and it seems that it's so black and white where which position he puts himself. It so happens there's a dispute amongst Rambam commentators where does he stand on this issue, that perhaps he used the word Dechuya in his opening word in the source number 3 loosely and didn't mean that technical word Dechuya against Hutra. And one of the reasons that he says that, if you just take a look at the Halacha Bet, that middle paragraph, the last line of it, the second to the last line, Kelosho Davar, the rule is Shabbat Legabe Chole Sheyesh Bo Sakana. How do we relate to Shabbat with regard to a chole, a sick person who's in mortal danger? Harehu kichol lechol hadvarim shutzurich lahem. It's like weekday. Which seems to mean that it's hutra. And there are plenty of Gedolei Yisrael who took this line in the Rambam to mean that when he wrote the word tchuya earlier, he didn't mean it. Because here the Rambam is clearly saying, harehu kichol lechol hadvarim shutzurich lahem. Consider it weekday. But there are others, like the Rav, who believe that the Rambam says that it is Dechuya, and you do have to consider. And if that's the case, how come the Rambam said that if you're going to do something already, don't do it by using a goy? Why not? If two people are standing here, a Jew and a non-Jew, both can make the same phone call to an ambulance, right? Why shouldn't the goy make the phone call? A goy, if I tell a goy to do something on Shabbat, that's a rabbinic restriction. If I make the phone call on my own, perhaps I violated a biblical restriction. So here you have an option to do it. The phone call is going to be the phone call. There's no loss of time, no difference at all, whether I make the call or he makes the call. So why does the Rambam say, lo yedei goyim? There would be the preferred option. So if you say that it's hutra, then okay, say I understand, because you know the goy is not a factor. But if it's dechuya, then I should have opted for the goy first because it's only a rabbinic restriction. Like all of the gadgetry of Machon Tzomet, that doesn't mean that everybody can ride the motorized car and everybody can write with the Tzomet pen and so on. It means those people who have a particular need and have a heter from a Rav to use these things, what it does is it reduces the charge from biblical to rabbinic. That's important. That's no small matter in halacha, to reduce a charge of Chilul Shabbat from Doraita to Rabbanan. And then, when there's what's called Sha'at Tzorach, a great need, we can be matir, we can permit the Isur to Rabbanan. That's fair game. We understand that. So why did the Rambam simply say that Al-Dei Goy is the preferred option? And the Rav had a very big chiddush. Because he said, Pikuach Nefesh Doche Shabbat does not stem from the saving of the life, but it stems from the fulfillment of the mitzvah, v'chai bahem, and you shall live. And Chazal say, v'lo sheyamut bahem. And that is a biblical mitzvah. The mitzvah is to guarantee preservation of life. The goy never received that mitzvah. He wasn't there at Har Sinai. We were there at Har Sinai. And therefore, you have an opportunity now to fulfill the mitzvah of v'chai bahem, and you shall live. The way Chazal interpreted, v'chai bahem v'lo sheyamut bahem, so the person should not die, don't give it over to a goy. So it's not because of the saving, but it's because of the mitzvah of v'chai bahem. An interesting take on how the Rambam understood this. But now, we're going to just digress a little bit, not digress, but get back on track actually. Source number four. What does this pasuk have to do with the discussion from Hallel? Lo ameitim yahalleluya, velo kol yordei duma. So yordei duma is somebody who went into permanent slumber, which means he's dead. So is this just poetry? Beitim yordei duma. It's in all likelihood that's what it is. David HaMelech is using synonyms and different phrases, so he's not going to say velo kol meitim. He says lo meitim yahalleluya velo kol yordei duma. It could mean that even if a person is not dead yet, but a person is comatose, that's yordei duma. So that person can no longer sing the praises to God. In Hallel, what are we doing? We're thanking a Kadosh Baruch Hu that we're around to tell the story. It's a long-winded version of Shehechiyanu, Vikimanu, Vigiyanu, Lazman Hazeh. What do we make that bracha for? That bracha says, thank you, I made it to this occasion. It's the bracha of life. That's all, the bracha of survival. And I remember the Rav once saying, you're going to have a hard time convincing me that somebody who said a Shehechiyanu on something, it would be a bracha levatala, a bracha in vain. If a person feels tremendous simcha that he or she made it to a certain juncture in life, and said, and wants to say it, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Shehechiyanu, Kimanu, Kiyanu, Lazman Hazeh, you're not going to be able to tell me this is a bracha levatala. It's not going to work. Because that's a bracha, he's thanking HaKadosh Baruch Hu for the moment of simcha. And you can even see that at weddings, you know, Chazal never established the bracha of Shehechiyanu for a wedding. Never. And there are a thousand reasons why not, by the way. And yet, what did the Jewish custom do? Snuck it in the back door. Yeah, whether it's a talis or this or that, you know, all kinds of things now have, and now the kala wants to say the Shehechiyanu too. Why not? You know, like, it's just become upgraded that there's a Shehechiyanu under the chuppah, and the only question is, at what point and how are we going to get it in there? But when you consider the bare bones ceremony of the wedding, it doesn't, the mitzvah doesn't go along with the Shehechiyanu. So that in itself, I said, requires an answer. One of the answers sounds a little corny. It says, you don't know how it's going to turn out. So therefore, in retrospect, it may not be Shehechiyanu. But all right, you know, not everybody has such a good sense of humor. It could be painful reasons why Chazal didn't make a Shehechiyanu. But whatever it is, there's no Shehechiyanu. So nevertheless, Am Yisrael put a veto and said, no, we want to say a Shehechiyanu. It's a great moment of simcha. Why not? So, you know, just to be halachically safe. So, you know, you're putting a talis in. I mean, we do this on second night of Rosh Hashanah also. So, you know, there's a whole question, you know, say a Shehechiyanu at Kiddush or not, and so on, or on Adlakat Neirot of second night Rosh Hashanah. So you put a new fruit, you have to say a Shehechiyanu anyway. So it's a gimmick. I mean, one of my famous family stories that half my kids think I made it up because I said it over so often, and they might be right. It was when my daughter Chana was 6 years old. We moved to Yerushalayim. She never saw a snowflake in her life. And it snowed, that's the winter, on the porch. We were in Ramot already. And she was so happy, she wanted to make a Shehechiyanu. So I said, well, we have to take a look at Shulchan Aruch. Haro'esh Shelig B'pamari Shona. You know, do you have to make a Shehechiyanu? So, but before I even gave an answer, she ran to the closet, took out on her pajamas, she put on a new sweater, ran out to the porch, and made a Shehechiyanu on the sweater, and had in mind the snowfall. So I said, where did you get that idea from? She said, from the fruit on the second night of Rosh Hashanah. No? She was a London at six. At six. Yeah, she was the one that's meeting. So as my daughter Chana says now, that story may have happened, but maybe it didn't, but it certainly could have happened. It could have happened, yeah. That's for sure. So lo ameitim yahalleluya velo kol yordei duma means that after a person dies, there's no more praising God. Which means it's over. It's not just no more praising God. There's no more possibility of advancing the cause of Kiddush Hashem in this world. What exactly does the Kadosh Baruch Hu want with the created world? He wants man, and we were given, Am Yisrael, a mission to do this, but non-Jews are welcome to be active participants, to bring God's presence back into this world, where we understand that the created world, Biyat Olam, means that God, as if to say, we say Kaviyachol, as if to say, stepped out of the bounds of the created world, and left a vacuum with him on the outside, him with a capital H, on the outside. This in the Kabbalistic literature was called Tzimtzum. It's a concept that's been developed. And what does the Kadosh Baruch Hu want from us? That we should constantly invite him back in by doing mitzvot and by going beyond the technical mitzvot, but to try to find a place where Shaviti Hashem Lenegdi Tamid, where God is in front of you all the time. All the time. That's a task. That's a challenge. No doubt. Rav Kook, Zechron al-Bracha, used to use the phrase that while the halakha divides between Kodesh and Chol, sacred and profane, says actually the Yadut, Judaism, divides between Kodesh and potential Kedusha. Potential Kedusha are all those zones of the created world that have not yet been invited, have not yet invited a Kadosh Baruch Hu's presence. So that's why they're called Chulin, Chol. They're secular. They're secular because God's presence didn't make it yet, but waiting for a draft call or an invitation to come in. So whether we're talking about place, time, clothing, thoughts, whatever it may be, everything of the created world, we say it under the chuppah. Sha'kol bara l'chvodo. Everything was created from Breshit Bara for the purpose of bringing Kvod Shemayim. The Rav gave a whole shir about brachot, that every time you take a drink of water, you say, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Olam Sha'kol Mi'eh B'dvaro, you have brought a Kadosh Baruch Hu into this world through a cup of water. And this is one of the great reasons that the Chassidim, not only were the Rebbe smart enough to know that the way to your neshama is through your gastronomical system, and you know, you put out a few good kugels and you got the Chassidim coming rolling. But not only that, but the idea was to say a bracha over it. And you say a bracha over it, so there's something of a Kadosh Baruch Hu attached to it, and that's why the Chassidim would grab the shirayim, you know, the extras, because there was something holy. It wasn't just because the Rebbe is eating this piece of kugel, but there's Shem Shamayim on this piece of bread or challah, whatever it may be. And that's an important Hasidic concept. But it's based on the general Jewish idea of what this is. And that's why, if you take a look, for example, in Rosh Hashanah Fal Hirsch, his parish on Parshat Emor. So Hirsch, you many times will explain words by their etymology, how the word was formed. So he says, what does the word Kohen mean? He says, Kaf Hei Nun really comes from Kaf Vav Nun, which means Kivun, direction. It's the person who shows direction. So he's the guide. The Kohen is the guide. The Kohen, Kohanim are the Mechavnim. That's what their job is. And in all other religions, Rav Hirsch writes correctly, so when does the priest of many of the ancient religions, when did the priest's task begin? When a person died. And then they needed the priest to prepare him for the afterworld and so on. The minute a person dies, Mr. Kohen goes home. L'nefesh lo yitama be'amav. We don't need the Kohen anymore when the person died. We need him when he's alive, when the person's alive. To teach Torah, as in Shevet Levi, because the Kohen was a Levi, he was a teacher. And the idea of Yoru Mishpatecha Yaakov V'Toratcha Yisrael, this was the job of the Kohenim and the Leviim, to teach when you're alive. I remember many years ago, in the 80s, they were building a hotel in Tveria, one of the hotels, and you know, a city like Tveria, when they start digging, inevitably, they're going to hit bones. And when they hit bones, then in Me'er Sha'arim, they come alive. Me'er Sha'arim, they come alive because it's a wake-up call for burning garbage bins and snarling traffic and making all kinds of demonstrations. And I remember the signs, you know, we call the Pashkabilim, the signs on the billboards, you know, Kedushat HaMetim, the sanctity of the dead. So Rabbi Danny Trapper, who now I'm very close with, but then I knew him just vaguely, wrote an article in Ma'ariv, and he wrote, right, Kedushat HaMetim with a question mark. There is no halachic category called Kedushat HaMetim. There's what's called Kvod HaMet, respect for the dead. The word sanctity comes to a dead end the minute a person dies. There's no Kedusha. It's Tumah. That's what it is. The body is the Avi Avot HaTumah, and anybody in close contact becomes Tameh, and so on. Tamei is the antithesis of Kedusha. So there's no Kedushat Meitim. There's Kvod HaMet, and that has to be understood. So, Lo HaMeitim Ya'aluya V'lo Ko Yodei Duma, it's over. So it really means that whatever person accomplished in life, for good or for bad, that's where the line is drawn. And on that basis, a person is going to be judged Bebeit Din Shalmala in the heavenly court. Is it really over? Is it really, really over? Finished? You know? I mean, the whole idea of, let's say, St. Kanish for 11 months is that if that something could be changed, perhaps, reduced charge, perhaps, neshama comes up and Kadosh Baruch Hu accuses the person of this and that and this and that. But then the neshama says, all right, listen, I wasn't such a good person, but take a look. I left over a child could be 50 years old, a descendant, who's sanctifying God's name in public. What is Kaddish? Kaddish has nothing to do with death. Nothing at all to do with death. It's a proclamation of Kiddush Hashem, sanctification of God's name, in public, in a minyan. That's what it is. When you say it's Gadol V'Kadesh, Shmei Rabba, God's name should be, great and glorified and sanctified. Where? Throughout the world. Be'olma Dibra Kirutei V'Yamlich Makutei, in the world that He created. And when is that going to happen? Ultimately, in the days of Yemot HaMashiach. Yehi Shmei Rabba Mevarach, in Hebrew, is Yehi Shem Hashem Mevarach Me'ata V'Olam. This is the eschatological vision of Kadosh Baruch Hu being, accepted universally. And that's what you're saying, proclaiming it in front of a minion. Minion means in front of Klal Yisrael. It's Kiddush Hashem. So Neshama can say, look, I wasn't so bad. Take a look. I have children saying Kaddish. So that helps, right? That we know that what unfortunately some people have made out of this is they think there's a scorecard up there that if you don't say 1,521 and a quarter Kaddishim during the 11 months, something's going to go wrong with the Neshama. That's not true, because if you're familiar with the Frankfurt Jewish community, an Ovel may have said Kaddish once in 2 weeks because they had rotation. One, the Irgei Shul in Zurich, I saw this with my own eyes. I don't know how they did it in the Yitzitzeh. The one Kaddish Sayer was, and it was rotation. So in the smaller shuls, I call them the Reform Yekis, that everybody else who wanted to say Kaddish mouthed it silently. But you didn't have, like you have here, a chorus of people saying Kaddish. What I did know in the Chama, by the way, I moved all the Kaddish Sayers to the middle of the shul by the Bima, and they all say it in unison. And that really has a very good, healthy effect, because Aleph, everybody hears the Kaddish, and they respond at the same time, as opposed to having a guy here, and a guy there, and a guy there, and now we have some women saying Kaddish too, so, you have to have it in unison. When it's in unison, then it works. Yeah, Fakshan.
In the Korba, but there's only one Kaddish, only one person saying Kaddish.
That's Minhag Frankfurt. That's the Minhag. That's the, yeah.
What do you do with all the Jewish people who are getting cremated?
Yeah. Okay.
It's happening.
It's very, of course, I know it's happening.
Do you fit shiver?
So listen, I'll just digress for a second. The problem with cremation is that there's a violation of the mitzvah of burial. That's what it is. It's the violation. It's desecration of the corpse, and it's a nivul hamet, and that there's a. There's a question whether it's considered kfura. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva that the burial of ashes is considered kfura. But unfortunately, there are people who have in the world who go through cremation and they save the ashes in a jar of some sort in the family. So there's no kfura. Rav Moshe says that if buried, it does have a halacha of kfura. But not everybody agrees with that. Rabbi Maurice Lamb, Olav Shalom, wrote a phenomenally good book for Balabatim, for laymen, on Avelos. It's a very, very good, handy book. It's only one catch, that there's no sources. In other words, you have to take his word for everything. And I remember seeing in his book, he wrote that if there's a cremation, so the family should not sit Shiva, and there's no Avelos, and there's no Kaddish, or anything. And the truth of the matter is, when he sat Shiva himself in Ramat Eshkol, but in his sister's house, for one of his parents, I asked him, I said, what's the source? Where do you get this from? And he couldn't remember. So I said, his name was Rav Moshe Lamb. Maurice Lamb is Moshe Lamb. I said, there was a Moshe who was even greater than you, had the same problem. His name was the Rambam. The Rambam late in life. The Rambam also wrote no source material to the Mishnah Torah and was subjected to no small amount of opposition in his lifetime. Where are the sources? Imagine giving in a doctoral dissertation at a Hebrew university, and you tell the professor, smoch alai, trust me. No bibliography, no footnoting, no nothing. Smoch alai, That the garage guy can tell you when he fixes your car. It's not going to fly in the Hebrew U. So the Rambam was upset late in life. He said, I actually wanted to make a volume for myself, a notebook, and I never even did that. Somebody asked him a question. Well, what's the source of a particular halacha? And he said, he looked in, he didn't remember. So I told Rabbi Maurice Lamb, these things happen. But why did I say that? Because I had a family in Ramot I'm not getting into details here, but a person lost a parent in Chutz La'aretz, and they were assimilated Jews, the parents, and they did a cremation, and they had family approached me also with the question of, and I remember this line in Rabbi Maurice Lamb's books. I called Baron Lichtenstein, Zichron Lebracha, and I spoke to Rabbi Mital also about it. You know, Rabbi Aaron said they should start sitting Shiva immediately. I mean, the bottom line is that they didn't do the mitzvah of Kvura, but we sit Shiva today if the parents are not Shomer Shabbos. We sit Shiva for parents who are not Torah observant, right? No, don't think that that's not such an easy issue. If a parent is a heretic in Apokyrus, so then the Rambam says then there's no Shiva. But a person just doesn't do mitzvot, there's no grounds for the children not to mourn the loss. So we do. So, you know, not doing a mitzvah is less of a crime in Torah than violating Shabbat. No question about that. So if he said a kal v'chomer, he said if we sit Shiva for a person who's a mechal Shabbos, certainly for a family who didn't do kfura. You know, this can happen too if a person donates his body to science, and there really may not be a kfura. So then a person has to be mitabel immediately. You do kriya, and you sit Shiva, you say kaddish, the works. And Rabbi Mital thought, it's just that this may have been Rabbi Maurice Lamb's attempt at American Jewish society of holding the line against cremation. Like he was hoping, perhaps, that if the people would know the family's not going to sit Shiva and not say Kaddish, maybe that would hold them back from authorizing a cremation, which in many cases doesn't, because the children, you know, may not be Kaddish sayers anyway, but whatever. But nevertheless, there was no basis. There was really no basis, you know, for that kind of a line, and so on. What I'm going to get to before we finish the shiur is source number 5. And that is to show that there is spiritual life. It's still on the first page. I didn't get to the second page yet. There's spiritual life in terms of calculating one's averot and mitzvot, even if a person passes away. Now, this is a very big chidush, very, very big chidush, novel idea of the Rav. The Gemara in Masechet Arachin Daf Yud talks about Hallel on various occasions. It says there that there are 18 days that we complete the Hallel. And those are the 8 days of Sukkot, 8 days of Hanukkah, that's already 16. 1 day of Pesach, the first day of Pesach, we complete the Hallel because the rest of the Hallel on Pesach is abbreviated. And certainly on Rosh Chodesh it's abbreviated, so it doesn't count. And 1 day of Shavuot. So it's 18. And then it says the Chutz La'aretz is 21, because you add the extra day of Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot of Yom Tov Sheni. Fine. So in Chutz La'aretz is 21 days, you complete the Hallel, and Eretz Yisrael 18. And then the Gemara goes on to explain why these 18, and why not this, and why not Purim, and why not Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. So with regard to Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, the Gemara says in source number 5, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippurim, the ikru mo'ed v'ikdush ba'asiyat melacha. The Gemara said a type of criteria that if it's called a mo'ed and it's a day of isa melacha, then those are the days that Hallel should be said. So the Gemara says, one second, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, they're called mo'adim. It's there in Parshat Emor, Eile mo'adei Hashem Mikrei Kodesh, they're there. And there's also Isum Malacha, no doubt, there's prohibition of work, Lema, then we should say Hallel. How come we don't say Hallel? So the answer is, Mishum the Rabba Bau, because of the statement of Rabba Bau, the Amar Rabbi Abau, what did Rabbi Abau say? Amru Malachei Asharet Lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the angels said to God, Rabbono Shel Olam, Mibnei Ma Ein Yisrael Omrim Shira Lefanecha B'Rosh Hashanah B'Yom Kippurim. Why, my gosh, the angels are complaining to God. Why are Am Yisrael not saying Shira today on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur? Amar Lahem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu responds, Efshar, is it possible, is it conceivable? Melech Yoshev Al Kisei Adin, God is sitting in judgment, V'sifrei Chayim V'sifrei Meitim P'tuchim Lefanav, and the book of life and death are opened, V'Yisrael Omrim Shira Lefanai. That's gonna sound like bribery? Shh. Bribery. Shochad. It's going to sound like Shochad. So in other words, it's this, you can use the Yiddish. It's pasnish. That's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu said. It's not inappropriate that on the days of din, of justice, of judgment, that Am Yisrael is going to start overloading with Hallel. Just not appropriate on Yom HaDin. Okay, so that's the end of the discussion in the Gemara, and there is no Hallel on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. But what does it mean, that underlined phrase, V'sifrei Chayim V'sifrei Meitim P'tuchim Lefanav, the books of life and the books of death are open before him? Popularly interpreted, This is the cardinal question of the Antana Tokef. Mi yichye, mi yamut. Right? Barosh Hashana yikotevun, uviyom tzom kipur yechotemun, kama yavrun, kama yibereun, mi yichye, mi yamut. Who's going to be in this book? Who's going to be in that book? And don't we say this? Zochreinu l'chayim tomim, v'chotveinu b'sefer achayim? That's what we're asking. Yeah, the books are open, and the Kadosh Baruch Hu is going to be inscribing everybody in one of those two books, and you want to make it to the Sefer HaChaim. That's the whole push for Aseret Yemei Tshuva until Chotmeinu B'Sefer HaChaim by Nila. Fine. The Rav said that's not what this is. He said Sefrei Chaim, Sefrei Metim Petuchim Nefanav means that on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, God opens two books. He opens the books of those who are currently alive, and he opens the books of those who have long departed. So why open those books? I understand opening the books of those currently alive, because everything's up for grabs now. It's Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. But what relevance does it have to opening up the books of the Sifrei Mitim, those who are dead? Those who are dead. Lo Amitim, Yahalluyah, V'lo Koryodei Duma. It's over. It's over. What's there to judge? As if to say there's still some judgment going on. So Rav suggests that many times there's unfinished business. Person dies, and there are many activities that are clearly mitzvot and clearly avirot. But there are also activities that a person does that are very powerful. They cannot be defined as neither mitzvot nor avirot. They're neutral in their definition, what they did. But sometimes when a person does something, it kicks into motion something else. It triggers a reaction or a dynamic flow. And you may have done something unwittingly that kicked into motion a big chesed. A big chesed. Because of what you did, you didn't have a clue what you're doing, but you did it anyway. And it generated something that somebody else then did something great, because the person was inspired by something that you did. You are going to be rewarded many, many, many years later. The neshama is going to be rewarded because HaKadosh Baruch Hu makes that calculation of the post-death experience. What's left? This activity that was not around even. You couldn't even put your finger on it. Couldn't define it when the person was alive. But it has to be taken into account. And what if it's an avera? What if it's an avera? You did a neutral act, and because of the neutral act, it drove somebody or stimulated something to develop into what essentially is an avera. You didn't do it as an avera. And if you would have been alive, in all likelihood, a Beit Din would never have held you accountable because it wasn't your act. It's called grama. You kicked it into motion. But grama benizichin, the Mishnah in Baba Kama says, you might be patur bidei shamayim, bidei adam rather, that the three dayanim cannot convict you on it. But bidei shamayim, you're still going to be held accountable. If you do something that there's long-range implications, you're going to be held accountable for it. And therefore, there might be additional avirot entering into the file way after a person passes away. What?
If you did it without kavanah.
Even without kavanah. But the fact that you did not anticipate that your act could conceivably have brought out something that might be negative. On some level, it's not a full-blown avira, but on some level, there's going to be some measure of accountability. And this the Rav said in order to answer a question that's been asked about a pasuk in Chumash, the mitzvah vidui, confession, which the Rambam says is the positive mitzvah that's associated with tshuva. So what does the Torah say? V'tvadu et avonam v'et avon avotam. And you shall confess the sins of yourself and your forefathers. 1 second. That contradicts the pasuk in Parashat Ki Tetzeh. Lo yumtu avot al banim, uvanim lo yumtu al avot, ish b'chet'o yumatu. God will not help you, will not execute because of the sins of your father, and the father won't be executed because of the sins of your son. Each person's got his own file. Ish b'chet'o yumatu. Everybody's got his own file. So why should anybody ever say vidui, confession, for avirot of a father and a grandfather? Why should you do it? What relevance is that? And we do say this in our Tachnun. Aval anachnu va'avoteinu chatanu. What's the va'avoteinu? That's because of the pasuk. V'tvadu et avonam et avon avotam. The Rav said it's we have the obligation for unfinished business. We, the descendants, the children, the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren, we say Vidui on Yom Kippur, we also take into consideration those who are not with us. And the Rav said, this is the genesis of the original minhag of Yizkor on Yom Kippur. There was never Yizkor on the Chagim. That's a late invention, if in the 17th century. Yizkor was a Yom Kippur experience. As the Torah already foreshadows, how is the mitzvah of the Avodah of Yom Kippurim given in the Torah? Vayedaber Hashem al Moshe, acharei mot shnei bnei Aaron, bekorvatam lifnei Hashem vayamutu, vayom Hashem el Aaron achicha vayavo b'cholet al HaKodesh. That the mitzvah of Avodat Yom Kippurim is given against the background of Yizkor, of Elazar, of Nadav and Abihu. Now we know of their tragic passing already in Parshat Shmini. So why does the Torah have to start and tell us, Vayedaber Hashem Moshe acharei mot, and after the deaths of Nadav and Abihu? Because the Torah wanted to bring their neshamot into the picture. That Yom Kippur, everybody had to atone for Nadav and Abihu, who are no longer with us. And the Rav said, that's what Yizkor is. To bring the neshamot into the picture of our saying vidui on Yom Kippur. Aval anachnu vavoteinu. And he says, this is what Sifrei Chayim and Sifrei Meitim means. That Kadosh Baruch Hu keeps the Sifrei Meitim open as well. To consider the unfinished business. And when a person makes a donation in lifetime, that in the tragic, if God forbid, the tragic circumstances, that would nevertheless allow for an organ, a vitally important organ, to be used to save another individual, that person is going to get credit for the mitzvah of Hatzalat Neshamot, Hatzalat Nefashot, posthumously. It's part of the calculation of Hashanah Yom Kippur, of the Sifrei Meitim. It's not that, you know, you took out a card, you signed it, and that's it. No. If a person lives out to 120 years and no, the doctor's never needed, that doesn't mean it's not. First of all, there's Machshava Kemaseh. So fine, on that level, Kadosh Baruch Hu will take note that the person was prepared to do it. But if a person actually has to do it, and a person is halachically dead when it's done, so who gets credit for it? Who gets credit? The answer is that neshama is going to get credit. It's going to get credit for doing mitzvot. For doing mitzvot. I mean, I can even equate it to, let's assume a person gives a donation, a very big donation to a cause, and spreads it out for 20 years. People, donors do this for whatever reason. They want to give $1 million, but they'll give, you know, $200,000 a year for 10 years, whatever. And it's written in contract, by the way. It's written in contract, and even if a person dies, you know, the Yorshim are going to have to carry on with this and so on. Who gets the mitzvah? A person dies in the third year. And the family keeps paying, you know, giving this donation. In all likelihood, the original donor who made that donation. Because he didn't make the donation of $1 million in one clip. It's spread out. But much of that money would be donated posthumously. Who gets credit for the mitzvah of tzedakah? So there is still unfinished business here if the person passes away.
Scary.
Scary, right? Yeah. I heard what you said. I heard you.
Just what, you know, if there's an age limit on the I have a card. I don't imagine they're going to take my...
That's totally irrelevant. That's totally irrelevant. It's good to have it because every for another person who takes it out, it just gives chizuk to the whole movement.
No, but is there... Did you know if there's an age limit at which they don't...
I think they'll give a card to anybody. It doesn't cost them. They're not making any money. They'll give you a card to anybody.
No.
What age wouldn't they use an organ?
I'm saying...
Depending on the vitality of the organ, that's all. Depending on the vitality. There are some people, Rivka, there are some 40-year-olds who are already out, I don't want to say what, and there's some 90-year-olds who are spring chickens. That's right, you know that. So. Okay, there you go. Okay, you know what? You can put the pages back, and maybe we'll get to the second page next week, because I see there's still what to do in this department. Right. If you want to save the page, Bakasha, bring it next week.
I have to ask a question. Yeah. I'm going to wait for the
morning. Okay.
I'm not going to When?
Whenever you want to come back. If you're making the program on Thursday, you have really no